You're listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Manifestations of Karma. This is Lecture 8, entitled The Karma of the Higher Beings, given in Hamburg on the 25th of May, 1910. To resolve the contradiction placed before us at the end of yesterday's discussion, we need to call to mind again the two forces, the two principles, that have been shown to challenge as well as regulate our karma. We have seen that our karma is only brought into motion through our suffering the luciferic powers working in our astral body. These powers tempt us to express our feelings, instincts, and passions in ways designed to make us, in a certain sense, less perfect than we would be otherwise. While acting upon us, the luciferic forces call forth the ahrimanic forces that do not act from within, but work on us from without. We interact with the world around us, and the ahrimanic forces work through what meets us from outside. Thus, it is Ahriman who is evoked by Lucifer, and we human beings are vitally involved in the conflict of these two principles. When we find ourselves caught in the clutches of either Lucifer or Ahriman, we must endeavor to progress by triumphing over the ill that has been inflicted upon us. This interplay of activity of the luciferic and Ahrimanic powers around us can be understood quite clearly if we consider from a somewhat different aspect the case we alluded to in the last lecture. The case where someone succumbs to Ahrimanic influence, whereby he experiences all kinds of deceptive images and illusions. He believes that knowledge of one thing or another has been specially imparted to him, or is in one direction or another making an impression upon him, while another person who had preserved a sound power of judgment would easily recognize that the person in question has succumbed to errors and delusions. Last time, we spoke of those cases of clairvoyant delusions regarding the spiritual world, clairvoyance in the invidious case, and we have also seen that there is no other, or at least no more favorable defense, against the delusions of improper clairvoyance than a sound power of judgment acquired during our physical life between birth and death. What I said in the last lecture is particularly relevant in cases of misguided clairvoyance. In relation to the kinds of clairvoyance that have not been attained through regular training and properly controlled systematic exercises, but which manifest as a result of certain older inherited characteristics, in the form of visually perceived images or auditory messages, we will always find that the faculty of clairvoyance eventually diminishes or ceases altogether when the individual concerned finds himself able and inclined to take up serious anthroposophical study, or even to embark on a path of genuine and appropriate inner schooling. The real sources of knowledge will always be of help in cases of misguided, supersensible perception, provided that the individual concerned is open to them. But you must be careful to distinguish clearly between the different types of delusions. We all know that if, through the complexities of karma, someone has arrived at a condition in which he develops symptoms of persecution mania or megalomania, he will develop a whole system of delusive ideas, all of which he can substantiate most logically, but which are nevertheless delusive. It may happen, for instance, that he thinks quite correctly and logically in every other department of life, but has the fixed idea that he is being pursued everywhere for some reason or another. He will be able, wherever he may be, to form the cleverest combinations out of the most trivial happenings. Quote, "Here is that clique again, whose one and only aim is to inflict something or other upon me." Close quote. And in the cleverest way, he will prove to you how well-founded is his suspicion? In that way, a person may be perfectly capable of logical thinking, and yet give expression to certain symptoms of madness. It will be quite impossible to impress such a person by logical reasoning. On the contrary, if we make use of logical reasoning in such a case, it may well happen that this will challenge the delusive ideas, and the victim will try and find even more conclusive proof of the assertion resulting from his persecution mania. When we speak in the terms of spiritual science, we must be absolutely precise. When I emphasized, now and on a previous occasion, that spiritual scientific knowledge, when acquired through serious study or even systematic training, is an effective means against aberrant powers of clairvoyance, I referred to a totally different set of circumstances. In the present case, we are not concerned with trying to help by means of spiritual science. As a rule, one would try and apply ordinary common sense, but people like the one described are absolutely unamenable to it. Why should this be so? In a disease whose symptoms are such as I have described, we are dealing with a karmic cause related to earlier incarnations, earlier errors. What is manifested as an inner error is not and cannot be caused during the present incarnation. It proceeds from an earlier incarnation. Let us now try and get an idea of how something like this can be carried from an earlier into the present incarnation. For this purpose, we must envisage the course of our soul evolution. Outwardly, we consist of physical body, etheric body, and astral body. In the course of time, we have built into these sheaths, by means of our eye, the sentient soul into the astral body, the rational or mind soul into the etheric body, and the consciousness soul into the physical body. These three soul members we have developed and have built into the three sheaths where they now dwell. Let us suppose that in some incarnation we were so tempted by Lucifer, or in other words, we developed such egotistical impulses, greed, and other instincts, that our soul was laden with transgressions. These transgressions may be in the sentient soul, the rational or mind soul, or in the consciousness soul. This, then, is the cause which in some future incarnation will be implanted in one of the three soul members. Let us suppose that there was a fault attributable especially to the forces of the rational soul. In the state between death and a new birth, this will be so metamorphosed that it will be manifested in the etheric body. Thus, in the new incarnation, we encounter in the etheric body an effect that may be traced back to a cause in the rational soul of a preceding incarnation. But the rational soul of the next incarnation will, again, work independently in that incarnation. And it makes a difference whether this human being has previously committed this transgression or not. If he has committed it in an earlier incarnation, he now carries his fault in his etheric body. It is now deeper rooted and is not in the rational soul, but in the etheric body. But such rationality and good sense as we may acquire upon the physical plane will affect only our rational soul and will not affect the activity of our rational soul in an earlier incarnation, which has already been woven into the etheric body. For this reason, it may happen that the forces of the rational soul, as we now encounter them in human beings, are doing their work logically, so that the real inner being is altogether intact, but that the cooperation of the rational soul with the diseased part of the etheric body provokes error in a certain direction. In such a case, it is possible to reach the rational soul by means of the kind of reasoning we employ on the physical plane but not the etheric body. That is why neither logic nor persuasion will have any effect. Logic would be of little use were we to place someone in front of a convex mirror so that he could see his distorted image, and then try to convince him that he is mistaken in thus seeing the image. He will nevertheless see a distorted image. In the same way, the deluded ideas of a person are something quite separate from him, because his otherwise sound logic is not reflected in a sound manner by his etheric body. Thus, we can carry within our deep organism the karmic effects of earlier incarnations, and it is actually possible to show that the defect is present in a certain part of the organism, as in our etheric body, for instance. It shows us what we have provoked in an earlier incarnation through the luciferic influence and transformed subsequently. And the transformation from something inner to something outer takes place in the period between death and a new birth. Then Ahriman works his way toward us from out of our own etheric body. This is how Lucifer draws Ahriman toward our own etheric body. While the earlier transgression was luciferic, the receipt, as it were, is issued by Ahriman in the next incarnation. Then we have to free ourselves of the damage inflicted on our etheric body. This can only be achieved by working into deeper layers of our organism, and that itself requires more than the application of ordinary reason in one incarnation. A person displaying symptoms of paranoia in a particular incarnation will be confronted with everything he has done as a result of this Ahrimanic injury after passing through the portal of death, and he will live through the utter absurdity of the actions concerned. This in turn will foster in him the strength that will profoundly heal him for his next incarnation. For he can only be healed if that which he committed under the influence of the respective symptoms strikes him as absurd in the time to come in the outer world. This shows you how it is possible to support such healing. Logical reasoning is suited least of all to curing someone suffering from delusions. It will only call forth opposition. But you will be able to help by enabling the person, and this applies particularly to cases where such symptoms are manifested in early youth, to experience the nonsensical nature of his actions in all their crassness, by confronting him with facts whose crass nonsense will react back upon him. In this way, a certain amount of healing can be achieved. You can also contribute to healing when the truths of spiritual science have truly become the inner possession of your soul. When they have become the inner possession of your soul, to the extent that they become an integral part of you, your faith will be the strongest imaginable. Then your entire being will radiate these truths of spiritual science. These truths stream into the life between birth and death, enriching it, and at the same time reaching far beyond this life. With these truths, which represent knowledge of the supersensible world, you will achieve much deeper effects than with the truths of outer reason. While outer logical reasoning will get you nowhere, you will, provided you have enough time and opportunity, be able to apply the truths of spiritual science in your dealings with the person concerned. The impulses given in this way have power to achieve in this incarnation what could otherwise only be achieved during the transition from one to the next incarnation, namely, to work into the etheric body from the rational soul. For the truths of the physical plane can in no way bridge the chasm between the sentient soul and the astral body, between the rational soul and the etheric body, or even between the consciousness soul and the physical body. That is why we find over and over again that the tremendous wisdom somebody may have acquired on the physical plane about the sense-perceptible world bears very little relation to his world of feeling, to all the impulses and desires that permeate his astral body. Therefore, it is quite possible for a person to be ever so well educated, to possess much theoretical knowledge about matters relating to the physical world, to become something of an old professor, and yet fail to transform his drives and feelings and desires which relate to the astral body. He may know a lot about the physical world and yet be a gross egotist, because he absorbed the impulses associated with egotism in his youth. Of course, the two things can go hand in hand, the acquisition of knowledge about the outer world of the senses and a transformation of the astral and etheric bodies from within. And it is equally possible for a human being to absorb intellectual knowledge, to apply the forces of his rational soul to the physical plane, and yet fail to bridge that deep chasm between his rational soul and his etheric body. In other words, you will find again and again that knowledge of the outer world, however immense, rarely has the power to work into the formative forces of the body. When knowledge and truth really take hold of a person's entire being, you will find that this changes his physiognomy in the course of 10 years, and that you will be able to read in his face how he has struggled or wrestled with certain questions in his heart, for example. His gestures, too, will tell you that he has attained calmness through inner efforts. These things find their way into the human organism's formative forces, affecting its most subtle structures. Whatever an individual absorbs spiritually thus works into the most subtle parts of his entire organization. When the things which affect our soul relate to more than just the physical plane, we change fundamentally in the course of 10 years. The change will reflect the way in which we educate and change that which is within us. It is quite possible for one's facial expression to change in the course of 10 years. But unless the abyss has been bridged by inner means, the change will have been caused by external influences. In such a case, the force of change was not an inner transforming power. This shows us that it is only the spiritual which really unites with our innermost being, that has the power of deeply affecting our formative forces even in the period between our birth and our death, and that this transition, this bridging of the abyss, takes place through the working of karma between death and a new birth. For example, when all that the sentient soul lived through sinks into those worlds we pass through between death and a new birth, it will, without fail, emerge as formative power in the next incarnation. What did I do there? In this way, the reciprocal activity of Ahriman and Lucifer has become intelligible. And now we will see how this combined reciprocal activity presents itself when things are even more distant, when, for instance, the Luciferic influence has not only to cross the abyss between the intellectual soul and the etheric body, but has, as it were, a longer way to go. Let us suppose that in one life we are particularly susceptible to the influence of Lucifer. In such a case, we should, with the whole of our inner being, become considerably less perfect than we were before. And in the Kamaloka period, we should have this most vividly before our eyes, so that we should resolve to make a tremendous effort in order to balance this imperfection. This desire we incorporate as tendency, and in the next incarnation, with what have now become formative forces, we shape our new organism so that it must have a tendency toward balancing our earlier experiences. But let us suppose that the release of these Luciferic influences had been instigated by something external, by an external desire. Again, this must have been owing to the influence of Lucifer. The external could not have affected us had not Lucifer been active within us. Thus we have within us a tendency to compensate for that which we have become through the Luciferic influence. But as we have seen, the Luciferic influence of one incarnation challenges and attracts to itself the Ahrimanic influence in the next incarnation, so that the two act in alternation. We have seen the Luciferic influence to be such that we can perceive it with our consciousness. That is, our consciousness can just about reach down into our astral body. We have said that it is owing to the Luciferic influence when we are conscious of pain. However, we cannot reach down into what one might call the consciousness of our etheric body and physical body. It is true, even in dreamless sleep, we have a consciousness, but one of so low a degree that we have no knowledge of it in ordinary life. But this does not necessarily mean that we are inactive in this consciousness. Plants, consisting as they do only of physical and etheric bodies, have this consciousness. Plants live continually in the consciousness of dreamless sleep. The consciousness of our etheric and physical bodies is present also in our waking condition in the daytime, but we cannot reach down to it. That this consciousness may be active, however, is shown when we perform in our sleep somnambulistic actions of which we are later know nothing. It is this dreamless sleep consciousness that is active. The ordinary I consciousness and the astral consciousness cannot penetrate to the sphere of somnambulistic action. However, we should not conclude from the fact that in the daytime we live in our I consciousness and our astral consciousness that the other types of consciousness are absent. We are just not aware of them. Let us suppose that we have provoked a strong Ahrimanic influence through a Luciferic influence in an earlier incarnation. This Ahrimanic influence will then not be able to work into our ordinary consciousness, but it will take hold of the consciousness that dwells within our etheric body. And this consciousness will then not only make us organize our etheric body in a particular way, but even induce us to perform acts whose effects will make our etheric body's consciousness say, quote, "Now you may only purge from within you what the Luciferic influence, to which you succumbed so strongly in the earlier incarnation, has caused in you. And this you may achieve by acting in a way opposite to the earlier Luciferic transgression." Close quote. Suppose that a Luciferic influence had caused us to abandon our earlier religious or spiritual way of life in favor of one where we said, quote, "I want to enjoy life." Close quote. In other words, we took a mighty leap into the world of the senses. This would challenge the Ahrimanic influence in such a way as to provoke the opposite process. It then happens that, passing through life, we seek a spot where it is possible in one leap to return to spirituality from a life of the senses. In the one, we went with one plunge into gross material pleasures, and in the other, we try, by one leap, to return to a spiritual life. Our ordinary consciousness is not aware of this, but the mysterious subconsciousness which is chained to the physical body and the etheric body now urges us toward a place where we may await a thunderstorm, where there is an oak, a bench placed beneath, and where the lightning will strike. In this case, the subconscious mind has urged us to make good what we have done in an earlier incarnation. Here we see the opposite process. This is what is meant by an effect of Luciferic influence in an earlier life, and as a consequence, an Ahrimanic influence in the present life. Ahriman's cooperation is necessary to enable us to put aside our ordinary consciousness to such an extent that our whole being will obey exclusively the consciousness of the etheric, or of the physical body. In this way, many events become comprehensible. However, we must beware of concluding that every case of sudden death or severe injury, for example, should be traced to something similar, for this would be taking a very narrow view of karma. But there are ways of thinking, even in our anthroposophical movement, that display a really narrow view of karma. There are people who believe that their understanding of karma will lead them to a higher point of view, but who actually know very little about it. Were karma really as they conceive of it, the whole world order would have to be specially arranged in the interests of each single human being, so that each life should run harmoniously and be duly compensated. The conditions of one life would always be combined in such a way as to result in an exact balancing of the consequences of an earlier life. But such a viewpoint is untenable. Suppose someone were to say to a man who had met with an accident, quote, "This is your karma. This is the karmic result of your earlier life, and you at that time brought it on yourself," close quote. Were the same man to have some stroke of luck, then the other would say, quote, "This can be traced back to a good deed you did in an earlier life," close quote. If such words are to have any value, the person should have known what happened in an earlier life, which is supposed to have produced this result. If he had knowledge of that earlier life, he would see the causes coming from that life, and he would then have to look toward later incarnations for the effects. The logical conclusion from this is as follows. In every incarnation, certain things happen which are first-time events in the life of every human being as it evolves from incarnation to incarnation, and these will be karmically balanced in the next life. When one then examines the effects in the next life, it is possible to look back at the causes. If an accident happens, however, for which, in spite of all means at our disposal, we can find no causes in an earlier life, then we must allow for the fact that this will be balanced in a later life. Karma is not fate. From every life, something is carried into later lives. If we understand this, we shall also understand that we may find new events in our life which are of profound significance. Let us consider that the great events in the course of human evolution could not come about without being carried by certain people. At a certain moment, people must take over the intentions of evolution. What would the development of the Middle Ages have been had not Charlemagne intervened at a given moment? How could the spiritual life of olden times have developed if Aristotle had not, at a certain time, done his work? Always remember that you must conceive of Aristotle living in the very period in which he lived, if you want to understand the course of human evolution, because without him many things would have turned out differently later on. We see from this that people like Charlemagne, Aristotle, Luther, and so on, did not live at a certain period for their own sakes, but for the sake of the world. Nevertheless, their personal destinies are intimately connected with world events. Should we conclude from this, however, that what they accomplished is the expiation or the recompense for their previous merits or transgressions? Take the case of Luther. You cannot just simply ascribe everything he experienced and endured to his karma. You must be clear that those things which are due to happen in the course of human evolution must come about through human agency, and that these individual agents have to be brought out of the spiritual world without consideration whether they are fully ready in themselves. They are born for the purposes of human evolution, and a karmic path has to be interrupted or lengthened so that the individuality concerned may appear at a certain time. In such cases, a destiny is thrust upon specific individuals which need have no relation to their past karma. But to have achieved something between birth and death sets up on earth later cosmic causes. So that though it is true that a Luther was born for humanity and had to bear a destiny which had no connection with his former karma, yet what he accomplished on earth will be connected with his later karma. Karma is a universal law, and everyone is subject to it. But we must not only look back to our former incarnations, we must also look forward. From this point of view, it is only in a subsequent life that we can judge and justify earlier incarnations, for some of the events of this life do not lie in the karmic path. Let us take a case which actually happened. In a natural catastrophe, a number of people perished. It is not at all necessary to believe that it was in their karma that they all should thus perish together. This would be a cheap supposition. It should not be assumed that everything is attributable to earlier transgressions. There is an instance that has been investigated of a number of people who perished in an elemental catastrophe. This in turn caused these people to feel very closely connected at a later time. And owing to their common destiny, they gained the strength to accomplish something important together. Through this catastrophe, they were able to turn from materialism and brought with them in their next incarnation a disposition to spirituality. What happened in that case? If we go back to the previous life, we find that in this instance their shared destruction took place during an earthquake. At the moment of the earthquake, the futility of materialism presented itself to their souls, and so a mind directed toward the spiritual developed within them. We can see from this how people whose mission it was to bring something spiritual into the world were prepared for it in this way, which demonstrates the wisdom of evolution. This case has been investigated and authenticated by spiritual science. So we can show how primary events can enter human life, and that it cannot always be traced back to an earlier transgression if one person or several people meet with an early death in a catastrophe or an accident. Such an event may appear as a primary cause and will be balanced in the next life. There may be other variations. It may happen that someone has to meet with an early death in two or three consecutive incarnations. This can happen because the individuality in question has been chosen to bring to mankind in the course of three incarnations certain gifts that can be given only when living in the material world with such forces as result from a, in quotes, growing body. To be living in a body that has developed up to the 35th year is quite different from living in a body of greater age. For up to our 35th year, we direct our forces toward the body, so that the forces unfold from within. But then, starting with the 35th year, we only progress inwardly, and our life forces are continually engaged in battling against the forces from outside. From the point of view of the inner organization, these two halves of life differ in every respect from one another. Let us suppose that according to the wisdom which presides over human evolution, we stand in need of such people who can flourish only when they do not have to fight against what comes toward us in the second half of life. It may then be that their incarnations are brought to a premature close. There are such cases. At our meetings, we have already pointed to an individuality who appeared successively as a great prophet, a great painter, and a great poet, and whose life was always brought to an end through premature death, because what had to be accomplished by this individuality in the course of these three incarnations could only be achieved if these incarnations were terminated before he entered the second half of life. Here we see the strange interlacing of individual human karma and the general karma of mankind. We can go still further and find certain karmic causes in the general karma of humanity, whose effects show only at a later period. Thus the individual again sees himself caught up into the general karma of humanity. If we consider the post-Atlantean evolution, we find the Greco-Latin period in the middle, preceded by the Egyptian-Chaldean period, and followed by our period, the fifth cultural epoch. Our period will be followed by a sixth and a seventh cultural epoch. I have also pointed out on other occasions that in a certain respect there are cycles in succession of the various civilizations, so that the Greco-Latin culture stands by itself, but that the Egyptian-Chaldean period is repeated in our own. In the present cycle of lectures, I have already pointed out that Kepler lived in our period, and that the same individuality lived earlier in an Egyptian body, and was, in that incarnation, under the influence of the wise Egyptian priests, who directed his gaze to the celestial vault, so that the mysteries of the stars were revealed to him from above. All this was brought further in his Kepler incarnation, which took place in the fifth period, and which in a certain way is a repetition of the third. But we can go still further. From the spiritual scientific point of view, one can honestly say that most people are still fairly blind when it comes to the evolution of the world and human life. These correspondences, these repetitions, these cyclic lives could be followed in great detail. If we take a certain moment in human evolution, say, for instance, the year 747 BC, we shall find that it constitutes a sort of hypomoclean, a kind of zero point, and that what lies before and after this point corresponds in quite a definite way. We can go back to an epoch of the Egyptian evolution, and there we find certain ceremonial laws and commandments which appeared as given by the gods, and this they actually were. There were commandments which related to certain ablutions which the Egyptians had to perform by day. They were regulated by custom and by certain ritualistic prescriptions. And the Egyptians were told that they could only live in the manner desired by the gods if on this or that day they were to undertake a certain number of ablutions. This was a commandment of the gods that found expression in a certain cult of cleanliness. And if in the interim we encounter a period somewhat less clean, we now again in our own period encounter hygienic measures, such as are given to humanity for materialistic reasons. Here we see a repetition of what was lost at a corresponding period in Egypt. The fulfillment of what happened earlier is represented in the general karma in a most remarkable manner. Only the general character is always different. Kepler, in his Egyptian incarnation, had directed his gaze up to the starry sky, and what that individuality perceived there was expressed in the great spiritual truths of Egyptian astrology. In his reincarnation during the age of materialism, the same individuality expressed these facts in a manner corresponding with our period, in his three materialistically colored Kepler's laws. In ancient Egypt, the laws of cleanliness were laws of divine revelation. The Egyptian believed that he could only fulfill his duty to humanity by going to incredible lengths to ensure his personal cleanliness at all times. This preoccupation with cleanliness comes to the fore again today, but under the influence of a mentality which is entirely materialistic. Modern man does not think that he is serving the gods when he is obeying such rules, but that he is serving himself. It is, nevertheless, a reappearance of what went before. This is how everything in the world is fulfilled, totally cyclically, in a certain sense. And now you will begin to understand that the matters we summarized last time in a contradiction are not as simple as one might think. If at a certain period people were not able to take certain measures against epidemics, then these were times when people could not do so, because according to the general wise world plan, the epidemics had to take effect in order to give human souls an opportunity of balancing what had been effected through the Ahrimanic influence and certain earlier Luciferic influences. If other conditions are now being brought about, this is again due to certain great karmic laws. This shows us that we really must not consider such matters superficially. How does this agree with our statement that if someone seeks an opportunity of being infected in an epidemic, this is the result of the necessary reaction against an earlier karmic cause? Have we the right now to take hygienic or other measures? This is a profound question, and we should consider it from all appropriate angles. We must understand that where the Luciferic and Ahrimanic principles are cooperating or counteracting each other, whether concurrently or over longer periods, certain complications in human life will ensue. These complications appear in forms so diverse that we never see two identical cases. If we study human life, however, we shall find our way in the following manner. If in a particular case we try to discover the combined activity of Lucifer and Ahriman, we shall always find a thread by which this connection will become clear. We must discriminate clearly between internal and external man. We were already called upon today to differentiate sharply between that which is expressed by the rational soul and that which appears within the etheric body as an effect of the rational soul. We need to look at the train of events in which karma is fulfilled, always keeping in mind that there is the possibility at all times for appropriate karmic influences to affect our inner being in such a way that through this inner being different karmic compensations are prepared for future times. For this reason, the following may well happen. In an earlier life, we might have lived through intense feelings that drove us to act in an unloving manner toward our nearest and dearest. Let us imagine, for example, that we experienced something which karmically produced an unloving nature. It is certainly possible that we generate something bad as if on a downward spiral. In other words, that we descend to a certain point in order to develop the opposite impetus which will help us rise up again. So let us assume that due to our yielding to a particular influence, we have developed a tendency toward a certain unloving nature. This unloving nature will then manifest in a later life as a karmic effect and will produce inner forces in our organism. Now we may act in two ways, consciously or unconsciously. Our culture has not yet reached the stage to do it consciously. We can ensure that those characteristics that stem from an unloving nature are driven out of the organism of the person affected. We can introduce an antidote against the effect in the outer organism which manifests as an unloving nature. However, such action would only do away with the outer organ of lovelessness and not cure all the unloving substance in the soul. If we do nothing else, we have left the job half done, and have possibly achieved nothing at all. We may have helped the person physically, externally, but we will have done nothing for his soul. Now that we have deprived him of the outer organ for expressing his unloving nature, he can express it no longer. He has to retain it in his inner organism for a future incarnation. Suppose that a great number of people had felt impelled, due to their unloving attitude to their fellow human beings, to absorb certain infectious substances in order to succumb to an epidemic. Let us further suppose that we could do something about this epidemic. In that case, we would prevent the outer physical nature from expressing the unloving disposition while failing to remove the inner inclination to unlovingness. What we need to envisage now is the following. By removing the outer organ of unlovingness, we actually incur an obligation of working into the soul in such a way as to remove its inclination to unlovingness. The organ of unlovingness is killed in the most complete sense, in the outer physical sense, through the smallpox vaccination. Spiritual scientific research has shown, for example, that smallpox developed during a time when the general inclination toward egotism and unlovingness reached a particular climax. That is when smallpox emerged in the outer organism. This is a fact. In anthroposophy, it is our duty to speak truthfully. This will enable you to understand why vaccination was introduced in our time. You will also understand why the best minds of our time display a kind of aversion against the practice of vaccination. This aversion corresponds to something within. It is the outer expression of an inner reality. What I would like to say is this. If on the one hand we kill the organ, we incur an obligation to follow suit by working to transform the respective person's materialistic nature by means of a spiritually oriented education. This would be the necessary counterpart of our measure. Without it, our work is incomplete. Indeed, we are merely accomplishing something to which the person in question will somehow have to produce a counterpart in a later incarnation when he has the smallpox poison within him, while the inner characteristic predisposing him to smallpox has been removed. If we destroy the susceptibility to smallpox, we are concentrating only on the external side of karmic activity. If on the one side we go in for hygiene, it is necessary that on the other we should feel it our duty to contribute to the person whose organism has been so transformed something also for the good of his soul. Vaccination will not be harmful if, subsequent to vaccination, the person receives a spiritual education. If we concentrate upon one side only and lay no emphasis upon the other, we weigh down the balance unevenly. This is really what is felt in those circles which maintain that where hygienic measures go too far, only weak natures will be propagated. This, of course, is not justifiable, but you will see how essential it is that we should not undertake one task without the other. Here we approach an important law of human evolution, which acts so that the external and the internal must always be counterbalanced, and that it is not appropriate to act with regard to the one only, leaving the other out of consideration. Here we get a glimpse of an important relationship, and yet we have not even arrived at the significance of the question, what is the relationship between hygiene and karma? You will find that the answer to this question will lead us even further into the depths of karma. We shall deal with the karmic connection between birth and death, as well as the ways in which other people affect our lives. You will also learn how the human being's free will is in accord with karma. The end of Lecture 8.